Hello, on this week's program we listen back to an interview with pianist and broadcaster Christopher O'Reilly. His latest CD is released later this month. Jason Pfeiffer explores Hopewell Furnace, the colonial-era iron plantation, now a National Historic Landmark, recreates the business, technology and lifestyle of America's nascent industrial age. And Susan Lewis explores the French connection between America and the Emperor of early 19th century France in an exhibition on Napoleon at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Christopher O'Reilly is probably best known as the host of the nationally syndicated public radio show From the Top. The program, which features the cream of young classical musicians, can be heard Sunday afternoons on WRTI. In addition to his duties as a radio host, O'Reilly is a classically trained pianist who continues to tour and perform regularly. But he isn't just playing Mozart, Debussy or Shostakovich. In recent years, O'Reilly has been applying his classical know-how to some unexpected repertoire. Originally used as a fill between segments on From the Top, and spurred by his fascination with the rock band Radiohead, O'Reilly's classical interpretations of that band's music, as well as songs by the recently deceased folk rocker Elliot Smith and the 1970s British singer-songwriter Nick Drake, have been met with both critical and commercial success. In these recordings and in companion recitals, O'Reilly bridges two very different audiences. So when we met, I first asked Christopher O'Reilly why a classical musician would want to interpret rock and pop music.
I don't really approach the arrangements that I do by virtue of any sort of overarching concept. The fact that I ended up doing not one but two Radiohead records of piano arrangements had more to do with the fact that that was just the music in my head, and I was listening to just about, you know, nothing but Radiohead. But at the same time, there were other songs that were really catching my imagination, and I was actually doing other arrangements around the same time as I was doing Radiohead, including Elliot Smith and including, right at the very beginning of the whole process, Nick Drake. It's just a matter of what song I'm listening to hundreds of times and can't get away from. So it's never really a matter of a project, it's really a matter of just sort of a connection. With me, it's the same connection as it is for any of the classical repertoire that I play. I'm really quite compelled and drawn to particular sort of sensuous harmonic language that I feel is shared by people like Elliot Smith and Dmitri Shostakovich and Claude Debussy and Radiohead and Messiaen and various other people. That and also a sense of textural ingenuity. I've always been drawn to the music of Robert Schumann for the fact that, you know, even if he has hundreds of songs, each song has an accompaniment figure in the piano that is completely indelibly unique to that particular song. Likewise, with Radiohead, for instance, you don't have this sort of wall of sound kind of organization of musical structure. You have five members of the band, each of whom are contributing a particular thread to the overall texture, and that by itself suggests, you know, how one might go about devising a piano version of something like that. And it also gets me out of let's say, like a jazz musician would have certain physical habits at the piano. It draws me out of myself. You know, getting into, for instance, Nick Drake's guitar playing, there are certain patterns that he uses that if I'm trying to be true to them, makes my job easier in terms of I don't know, making it, you know, unique to Nick Drake and not just a matter of me sort of jangling around it with the patterns of my own hands. Similarly, with Elliott Smith's music, you have a widely diverse body of work between the studio versions of a song and, let's say, the 100 or so live versions of each song that Elliott wrote, and how he made choices, you know, from the studio version, which was largely self-produced with his material, to the solo live performances, in which case, well, you know, he's making choices. You know, what are the elements that are absolutely essential to the song, and so what choices has he made in that circumstance, and how should that affect the way I play it on the piano? Kinds of interesting sort of threads that sort of catch my ear and lead me into the song, and then the way through it is always a matter of editing and revision, and of course, you know, because it's not my material, it's my doing the best I can to make the other material come alive.
And is it the case that it's Chris O'Reilly using his language to express Nick Drake, or is Nick Drake teaching you a separate vernacular that in turn feeds into the other music that you play?
Well, I like to think that I'm trying, in the same way that I'm, you know, trying to approach a Beethoven concerto, trying to get inside what, you know, what was in Beethoven's mind, how he eventually, you know, wrote it down, makes a very large difference to me insofar as how far away I ever want to get from that kind of, you know, the law of the line, the law of the, you know, what's on the page. I'm you know, with Nick, I'm trying to understand what he was trying to do and get away from some of the extraneous things, you know, other playing styles that contributed to the album that may not really have been what he had in mind. And there are some pretty, you know, interesting examples of those kinds of disparities that make it really quite inspiring. So yeah, I don't really think of it in terms of doing it my way. It's just, you know, I guess the way that I hear things, the way that I try and emulate certain things that are unavailable to the piano, the way, for instance, you try and approximate the sound of the human voice. I give a large nod to Thelonious Monk in that regard, because a lot of what people refer to as wrong note playing, I try and imagine he was trying to emulate the voice. He was trying to emulate the plaintancy of the saxophone, etc. With Nick Drake, for instance, you know, one of the modes of authenticity that I'm most strict about is the way that he phrased. I mean, he was a remarkable musician in that he sort of was pigeonholed within the folk world. But at the same time, when you actually listen to his vocal phrasing, it's really straight out of the jazz tradition. And so that's an interesting juxtaposition within the style, this man almost singing to himself, but with an exuberance to the harmony and an exuberance to the rhythmic placement and the phrasing within the song that makes it, you know, unique, makes it Nick Drake.
Better set your prey today, for the sky to blow away, or maybe stay.
But yeah, Riverman particularly, you know, speaks to the jazz sensibility, I think.
Gonna see the Riverman, gonna tell him all I can about the band. On feeling free.
with this wide expanse of interest and of knowledge in all types of musical forms that you have, is there ever a point when the piano becomes restricting? Have you ever thought about perhaps having a larger ensemble? Maybe even think about conducting symphony orchestras, well, for instance.
Well, I think the piano, you know, part of what I'm doing is sort of showing off the instrument, you know, because I think it is capable of just about anything. I tend to think that what I'm doing is as little a reduction as possible. I'm trying to approximate the same kind of energy and the same kind of excitement that a full band version of any of the songs that I like maintain. But I haven't really felt compelled to make versions for, let's say, piano and orchestra, for instance, because I think historically, inherently, there's a sense of protagonist, antagonist, or protagonist and the Greek chorus, etc., in the same way that you have a Beethoven concerto, that I feel wouldn't serve a Radiohead song terribly well. Even songs like How to Disappear Completely, which have their sort of quarter tone string haze about them, I suppose could work quite well for piano and orchestra, but there again, the piano, the orchestra would just be mere background, and I like musicians, and I like them to feel engaged and like they're doing something important.
It's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thanks, Jeff.
Christopher O'Reilly. His latest CD, Out of My Hands, featuring his unique interpretations of songs by rock acts such as Nirvana, Pink Floyd, and The Smiths, is released on August 18th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Set about 50 miles west of Philadelphia in rural southeastern Pennsylvania, Hopewell Furnace helps to tell the tale of America's infancy. The property was once an important iron plantation, a self-sustaining community that produced iron products. It was established just a few years before the Revolutionary War. Now, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, while the National Historic Site today provides a glimpse into the colonial-era process of producing iron, it also sheds light on the economic and social structures of 18th and 19th century America.
Hopewell Furnace, with its old mansion, barns, shops, and other ancillary buildings, is enveloped by French Creek State Park. The over 7,000-acre expanse includes 40 miles of hiking trails, two lakes, rolling hills, and vast forest land. With sheep lazily meandering through neighboring meadows and the picturesque French Creek running through the property, there are few signs of the hustle and bustle that so often dominate modern life. While looking out over the grounds, park ranger Francis Delmar says Hopewell is indeed today very peaceful and beautiful.
Wouldn't have been if the furnace wasn't blast. Making iron is a dirty business. All of this would have been black.
Operating from 1771 to 1883, Hopewell Furnace was founded by Mark Bird. In developing his small iron furnace village near Elverson, Pennsylvania, Bird was part of a booming industry in colonial America. At a time, says Delmar, when the colonies were increasingly staking their economic independence from England.
Of course, the iron industry is so important in early America. It may have even played a role in starting the American Revolution because iron furnaces and iron forges completely ignored the British trade acts. You know, we were supposed to make the pig iron, ship it to England. They would make the products and ship them back. And that didn't happen. We just ignored it.
Once the Revolutionary War was underway, Hopewell Furnace and other local iron furnaces in Pennsylvania supplied George Washington's army with cannons and other iron products. Part of the reason Washington took his army to Valley Forge in 1777 was to protect the supply lines from iron furnaces like Hopewell along the Schuylkill River. After the war, however, Hopewell had trouble staying in business, largely due to the difficulty of collecting debt from the new American government. But as the iron plantation changed ownership in the decades that followed, the company became very profitable by the early 1800s, with the help of an improved economy. The success wasn't sustainable, however. As iron technology evolved, Hopewell Furnace became obsolete and finally closed down for good in the 1880s. Though the property was used as a summer home for many years, the federal government eventually slated the furnace and surrounding buildings for demolition. Franklin Roosevelt's Civilian Conservation Corps had plans to develop the French Creek region as a recreation area, but as the men from the Civilian Corps prepared to tear down the old buildings, Francis Delmar says they came across old company records on the furnace property.
They took them to a Park Service historian who came out here and looked and said, no, these buildings should not be torn down. This is the most intact iron plantation that exists, and this should be preserved.
Today, under the auspices of the National Park Service, Hopewell Furnace is a living history village with about a dozen 18th and 19th century structures scattered across the property, interpreted by park rangers and volunteer reenactors. The heart of the site is the red clay-roofed cast house. It's where the charcoal-powered furnace was fired up and the molten iron was cast. Dressed in a period costume, seasonal park ranger Walt Malowitz provides daily demonstrations of how the cast house would have worked. He says because there was no off and on switch for the furnace, it was a 24/7 operation.
For most of the year, the furnace ran continually. It was tapped from this tap hole twice a day, and about a ton and a half to 2 tons of iron would run out into trenches here in the sand where molders could either
Malowitz also points out the water wheel, powered by the French Creek, in the rear of the cast house. The large wooden wheel helped pump air into the furnace to keep the charcoal blazing hot, kind of like blowing on a campfire to keep it going. Hopewell's location directly beside the French Creek is no coincidence, then. The steady stream of water was important for the furnace's operation. According to Francis Delmar, there are three other main reasons that Hopewell's location was ideal.
This is very rich iron country out here. Iron ore lies just below the surface. Limestone lies just below the surface. Limestone, when you put it in the furnace, pulls the impurities out of iron, so you need that. And, of course, this was all virgin forest. So the third ingredient you need, the trees to make charcoal, are out here too.
Beyond the mechanics of making iron, the National Historic Site also looks to explore how the Hopewell community functioned as a whole in the 18th and 19th century. In certain ways, the village's social structure was an anomaly in early America, says Francis Delmar. For instance, African Americans, some of them runaway slaves, were often employed by the furnace, working side-by-side white employees and getting paid the same wage, and women would take on jobs that were typically only done by men.
Now, does that mean that the ironmaster in his house over there is some sort of forward-looking social pioneer? I don't think so. I think what he is a very shrewd businessman who wants to make a profit. What he wants is the woodcut to make the charcoal, to light the furnace, so he can have the iron that comes out of it. And who does that doesn't matter to him.
It indeed took an entire village to keep Hopewell's furnace running smoothly. A country store, boarding houses, a schoolhouse, barns, a wheelwright, and a blacksmith.
This is the original 1810 blacksmith shop. This is the forge that we have here with our small firebox.
Tom Bryan is just one of the handful of blacksmiths who helped demonstrate the craft of shaping metal at the Hopewell furnace during the summer. Bryan has been coming to French Creek Park and Hopewell since he was a Boy Scout.
It's just a magical little place here. And blacksmithing and actually being in costume down in the village, sometimes you get lost in what the reenactors call a period rush, where you have nothing modern around, and you're just going, wait a minute, is this the 1830s or is this the is this the 20th century?
How often does that happen?
A couple times a summer.
Visitors too seem to be looking for that period rush, according to Walt Malowitz.
I think a lot of folks like to feel that they're taking a step back in time, maybe away from our fast-paced way of life today. But sometimes if it's a really hot, humid day, they can leave here. I know I can. I'm glad to go home and take a shower and get in the air conditioning and find out that today's the good old days.
Though today, Hopewell Furnace isn't the dirty, polluting industrial site it once was, the village continues to illustrate a time when life was both much simpler, yet very hard. Its story is significant. While the small rural community was far removed from influential cities like Philadelphia, Hopewell Furnace nevertheless helped to lay a foundation, economically, technologically, and culturally, for a growing nation.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. On the heels of the 18th century American War of Independence came another revolution an ocean away. An exhibition now at Philadelphia's National Constitution Center explores the life of the ruler who emerged to make his mark on not only France, but much of Europe. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the French connection between America and the Emperor, Napoleon Bonaparte.
Americans, even those who aren't students of European history, are apt to recognize the image of Napoleon, the military commander standing upright in full dress coat, wearing a triangular-looking black hat with the side brim facing front, one arm bent at the elbow, one hand disappearing mysteriously between the buttons of his tunic.
A lot of people say that because he eats too fast. No way. It's because at the time, for the guy, it was no pocket on the pen. And the only place to put your arm, your hand, it was inside your jacket.
Pierre-Jean Chalasson has been studying, admiring, and collecting Napoleonic artifacts since he was a child.
My father gave me a book about him. And I said to my father, wow, look, this guy is great. It's like Superman. My father said, no, it's not Superman. He was real, you know, he was in real life.
In real life, Napoleone di Buonaparte was born in Corsica and grew up to be Napoleon Bonaparte, the French military commander. Stepping into the leadership breach left by the French Revolution, he eventually crowned himself Napoleon I, Emperor of France.
And I think Napoleon was a self-made man, because Napoleon was a simple guy from nowhere, not really French. He speak Italian and a bad Italian, a bad French. You know, it was a go-between. It's why Napoleon, for me, it's a big hero, you know.
Despite the recent destruction of the previous royal household, Napoleon created an imperial court with family members, colleagues, and friends. He embraced Enlightenment ideas about the rights of man, promoted the arts, and created civil codes for rational governance. But he also waged wars in the name of spreading those ideas across Europe, alienating himself from some who might otherwise admire him, both today and then. As one example, legend has it that in 1804, musical master Beethoven ripped the title page from his Bonaparte symphony and renamed it Eroica. Today, Daniel Thomas Easton, formerly Philadelphia's French consul, now director of a consulting firm, France Philadelphie, has mixed feelings.
He was, of course, instrumental in so many things, whether it is the emancipation of the Jews, the development of the metric system, the Napoleonic Code. But in terms of the slaughters, the many corpses left all over the battlefields of Europe, there may be some aspects that are a little bit somber.
And yet, says Easton, he also gave the French a sense of their nation.
It's something about your visceral sense of belonging. And with Napoleon, the myth, the grandeur of Napoleon, the martyrdom, the exile, all that has created an image of Napoleon that we don't really want to discard.
The show now at the National Constitution Center tells the story of Napoleon the man through items from the collection of Pierre-Jean Chalasson. Nearly 25 years after getting his first poster at the age of 14, Chalasson now has hundreds of books, maps, letters, furniture, clothing, fine china, and artwork, objects in which he takes more than a scholarly interest.
That's a big difference between a museum and a private collector. In the museum, the artifacts are not any longer alive, you know, because they are in a showcase and nobody use it. Me, I have books, I use it. I have silver, I use it. I have armchair, I use it. You know, it's important to use the things, because after, if you don't use, it's dead.
For this show, 300 of the objects are presented museum style. Visitors don't get to nap on the luxurious bed of Napoleon's brother, stretch out on the military camp cot, or sit at the elegantly set dining table. But on the walls hang large and small paintings, iconic portraits and large scenes of pomp and circumstance. Roman-style busts, silver, clothing, books, and personal items are protected in glass cases. The display presents a chronological narrative, from the Egyptian campaign to his assumption of power to his coronation and reign. Rooms are devoted to his family and the court he assembled, to his interest in the arts, and to his military endeavors, as well as his defeats and periods of exile. One of his famous hats sits in a glass case at the end. Text panels in each room explore the American connections. President of the National Constitution Center, Linda Johnson, points to the pivotal role played by the American Revolution.
We believe that revolution was in the air and that what we did here had an impact in France.
French financial support of the American Revolution had depleted the treasury of France. Discontent with the monarchy, joined with ideas about liberty and self-rule, gleaned from both Enlightenment scholars and from across the ocean.
The reformers in France looked to the American Revolution and the early American Republic as being the acting out of reform instincts.
Constitutional law professor A.E. Dick Howard of the University of Virginia says American state constitutions were translated into French.
Then the French could use the American constitutions as a point of departure for debating the kinds of arrangements they ought to have in France.
In the end, the French rejected the American constitutional model with its separation of powers and checks and balances, and instead invested all political power in its legislative body, the National Assembly. As a result, says Howard, as the French Revolution took an increasingly dark turn,
opposition to the National Assembly was opposition to the people, and that in turn was treason. What you finally had was the Reign of Terror, the guillotine, all the rest. And that move to the radical side, in effect, laid the foundation for the execution of the king, a period of turbulence, and the rise of Napoleon.
The spread of the Napoleonic Code of Civil Law through Europe created lasting constitutional differences from America's system, which looks to statutes, the Constitution, and precedent.
Basically, the Western world is divided into those which have the common law heritage, England, America, Canada, so forth, and those that are civil law countries, namely the continent of Europe.
There are personal connections between America and the French emperor as well. In 1803, Napoleon's brother Jerome came to the United States. He married an American and fathered a child, only to have the marriage declared annulled by the emperor. Jerome's grandson would become Attorney General under President Roosevelt and found what would later become the FBI. Another brother, Joseph, fled to the U.S. after Waterloo, where he lived for over 20 years, first in Philadelphia, then in Point Breeze, New Jersey. This exhibition, with its decorative arts and personal effects, is as much about Napoleon's artistic and private tastes as it is about his political prowess.
Like Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, you know, they used to love, they used to be sometimes not very nice, they used to make some mistakes.
This kind of exploration, says Linda Johnson, reflects the National Constitution Center's approach to understanding history.
One of the things we focus on quite a bit here is the personal ideology and lives of the founders. And I don't think it's any different for Napoleon. I think that in order to understand how these iconic figures rose to power and how they led, it just is very interesting to see also how they lived.
Understanding the human dimensions of those who change history helps shed light on not only the way we govern ourselves, but how we live our lives today.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The exhibition Napoleon runs through September 7th at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.